Can we explain the different rates of autism between males and females?
Lifetime risk of atrial fibrillation and its complications.
What are the adverse outcomes associated with any psychotic use in people with dementia?
And harnessing our electronic health records to improve our antibiotic prescribing.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, if you're okay with that, I would like to start with the BMJ and this issue of atrial fibrillation and its complications, which this was kind of a surprise to me, this study.
I tee this up as a lifetime risk of atrial fibrillation. And what it used, the Danish nationwide population information to look at how common is atrial fibrillation over a lifetime and specifically what complications are associated with it. They looked at two different decades, 2000 to 2010, and then 2011 to 2020, to compare those two different decades. Atrial fibrillation is an irregular heart rhythm where the upper chamber of the heart just kind of quivers. In the US alone, in the next 20, 25 years, there'll be about 16 million people that have it. What the Danes did, they said, okay, let's say you make it to age 45 and you haven't had atrial fibrillation. What's the risk that you'll get it before you turn 100? And once you have it, what are the associated complications? In the first decade, between 2000 and 2010, it was about one in four individuals over the age of 45 developed atrial fibrillation. In the most recent decade, it's now one in three. And that may be because we've had increased risk factors like high blood pressure and obesity and diabetes, and was more common in men as well. Here was a surprising thing to me. All healthcare providers, and most of our listeners will be aware that it's associated with an increased risk of stroke. And about 20% of the individuals experience a stroke after atrial fibrillation, despite the fact they're supposed to be on blood thinners. But the amazing thing, they were twice as likely, there were 40% of those that actually developed heart failure. And then about 15% developed a heart attack. And unfortunately, even though we've gotten better at diagnosing and trying to treat atrial fibrillation, the incidence of those decreased relatively minor, really modest decrease. So atrial fibrillation is on the rise, and the complications happen pretty frequently.
And I thought it was just surprising, this rate of heart failure. And I think they were a little bit surprised by that also.
Yeah, 40%. If you've got a one in three risk of developing atrial fibrillation and 40% of those develop heart failure, that says something. About a third of patients really don't have symptoms. When they do have atrial fibrillation, is to treat either with medications or we now have ablation to hopefully lower that risk. But more importantly is to prevent it from occurring. The same risk factors for heart failure are the same for atrial fibrillation. We can reduce the risk of atrial fibrillation and its complications if we control those things.
Allow me to also interject a question about exercise and its ability to prophylax against development of AFib.
So it's a really interesting thing, Elizabeth. If you're an elite athlete, it actually increases your risk of atrial fibrillation. But for those of us that do modest amount of exercise, 150 minutes a week, it actually lowers all the other risk factors and also reduces the risk of atrial fibrillation as well. So if you're serious about preventing heart failure and you're serious about preventing atrial fibrillation, a lot of that is within our control.
That's the good news. Let's turn, since we're over in this area of the world, to Sweden. This is JAMA Psychiatry, the study that was examining sex differences in autism heritability. Autism spectrum disorder, extremely common, feels like it's getting diagnosed more and more often. Nobody's ever really tried to nail this down in this particular way before. The authors put forward the fact that the cause of ASD is largely genetic, and they wanted to look at the sex-specific heritability of this disorder. Using the health registers of non-twin siblings and cousins from Sweden between 1985 and 1998, and they followed them up for 19 years of age, they had a sample of over a million individuals, with each family having about two children. 1.17% of that sample received a diagnosis of ASD, almost twice as many males as females. They estimate the heritability among the males at 87% and at 76% for females. It said there was no support for shared environmental contributions. And they posit a number of potential reasons that might be true, but they don't really come to a conclusion.
Part of that, Elizabeth, is even though that 2 to 3% of American kids will be diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder, ASD, and we know that there is some heritability, there are probably some environmental or other things that we just don't understand. Let me take a step back for a second, because some kids with ASD have intellectual disability and some don't. It appears that those with intellectual disability and autism, that the heritability between males and females is the same. But it's those that have the less severe form where it looks like the males have an increased heritability than the females. Now, maybe that they're more likely to develop it. Could be something about the females that's protected. Some of it is the age at which they're diagnosed, because females are typically diagnosed later than males, and the presentations are different. And they tried to account for all this by doing different modeling. I would agree with you that there's an increased incidence among males. Exactly why that is still unknown.
They talk about this female protective effect, which we've seen in other circumstances, that female sex just seems to confer protection. And we even know this if we examine lifespans, for example. They try to correct for so many of these factors, though, that seem like the usual suspects, like parental age, existence of the condition already in the family. And again, I feel like they are saying, yep, okay, there's a number of possibilities. And the answer is, we don't know.
Yeah, I mean, for almost 20 years, we've been reporting. We very seldom reported on ASD initially. And now it seems like we're reporting on two or three things per year. We're trying to get to the root cause.
Indeed. Okay, so let's turn to JAMA. What are we going to do about these antibiotics? How can we use them best in common infections?
Another surprising fact, approximately half of the hospitalized adults in the US receive antibiotics. So the two most common infections, by the way, are pneumonia and urinary tract infection. And again, over the last 2 decades, we've talked a lot about antibiotic stewardship, making sure the person has a bacterial infection, they're on the right antibiotic for their particular organism, and we keep them on it for the minimal amount of time. And we're doing this to try to prevent resistant bacteria, what are called multi-drug resistant organisms, or MDROs. And the way we typically do that is we admit somebody, we put them on a broad spectrum, and we do that because we don't know what the organism is, and we're concerned it could be a really deadly one. Get cultures to find out what bacteria is infecting them, and then 3 or 4 days later, we change the antibiotics. But what these investigators say, hey, wait a minute, less than 10% of individuals have a multi-drug resistant organism infection. Can we target those individuals for the broad spectrum? The rest of them use something that's less selective. To do that, they actually used the electronic health record, and they looked at 50 different variables. Some of them are related to the organism, some of related to the patient and their comorbidities and where they've been hospitalized. And it predicted whether or not they were going to have an infection with a multi-drug resistant organism and needed broad spectrum antibiotics, or they didn't. They reduced the broad spectrum antibiotic use in those with pneumonia by about 30%. And for those with urinary tract infection, reduced it by about 20%. Did it harm the patient? And they were in the hospital longer? Did they have to go to the intensive care unit? Did they have to switch antibiotics? The answer is none of those things. These were patients that were hospitalized with pneumonia or UTI, but weren't going to the intensive care unit. So it looks like the electronic health record can improve our antibiotic stewardship. But this is really a good news story.
It's a great news story. And I guess I'm interested in what some of those factors are that predict what specific organism someone might be infected with.
So they look at what I call a local antibiogram. What are the most common organisms causing pneumonia or urinary tract in that particular hospital region? And do they respond to antibiotics? And then there are patient-specific things like demographics and comorbidities. Do they have a prior healthcare exposure, which would increase that risk? 50 overall.
Well, I'm really interested in this notion that there are local flora, that there are certain organisms that are found in certain regions and that are most commonly going to cause infections. What I would love to see would be a study over time that looks, or seasonally, at variations among that population. And I'm sure we can get that data.
Yep. And in fact, what you mentioned is one of the limitations of this study. First of all, it requires a large EHR, and some small hospitals don't have it, or local doctors don't. The second is people move from region to region. So if we're going to really broadly apply this, we're going to have to look at how to overcome those things.
Finally, let's turn back to the BMJ. And this is a situation that we also have reported on previously, adverse outcomes associated with antipsychotic use in people with dementia. This is, however, a really big study from the Clinical Practice Research Datalink in England. They had adults 50 years of age or older with a diagnosis of dementia between 1998 and 2018, just shy of 200,000. Each new antipsychotic user which was 35,000 plus, were matched with up to 15 non-users using this incidence density sampling. What they wanted to find out was, all right, if you are on an antipsychotic, did you experience stroke, VTE, an MI, heart failure, ventricular arrhythmia, fracture, pneumonia, or acute kidney injury? And then they had as negative controls the outcomes of appendicitis and cholecystitis. Sure enough, if you were on a new antipsychotic, you did have an increased rate of primarily pneumonia. That was the biggest increased risk, but all these other risks were also increased with that. They did not observe any increased risk in appendicitis or cholecystitis. It was pretty concerning and confirmatory of what we've reported on previously.
Unfortunately, the use of antipsychotics in people with dementia, it was starting to decline. And then during the COVID years, it actually increased. We've known for, gosh, about 15 years that the antipsychotics are associated with the complications that you mentioned, and they really have very marginal benefit at all. We need to be really restrictive in who we give these medications to. For those that prescribe medications, to be aware of this, but also for caregivers as well, because we think it's the easiest thing to do is if mom or dad have dementia and we can try to control antipsychotics, we can actually increase the risk of these severe complications and shorten their life.
I guess my heart really goes out to care providers for people with dementia and the huge struggle it can be to deal with a lot of these behavioral issues. And so the temptation to turn to, and I should mention in this study that they note that risks are associated with both what are called atypical antipsychotics as well as typical antipsychotic drugs. And it just seems like, gosh, this is a fix for something that can be quite intractable.
It is. And so one of the things that the investigators mentioned is that we actually need to do more research into what are some safer drug treatments. If there are behavioral or environmental changes that we can make short of using medications, that would be the actually preferred treatment.
They note that the attempt to use other things hasn't been very fruitful either with what we have currently in the armamentarium. And let's just then end with the author's perception. They state that when an antipsychotic prescription is the least bad option, that clinicians should try to do it for the shortest period of time as possible.
Both the smallest dose, it gets a desired effect, and for as short as possible.
On
Great.
that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.